One other thing that's possibly interesting to mention is that a lot of the research on fasting is preclinical, so in model organisms, in lab animals, in mice and in rats. So a lot of times when you hear these kind of sales pitches, oh, it does this and it does that and it does the autophagy up and down and it just regenerates everything and you're going to be... A lot of the stuff is based on the mouse research. At least some of the things from the rodent research hasn't panned out in humans. For example, in mice, it seems that the benefits of intermittent fasting are not all explained by calories. So that's a sensational finding. And then, for example, this autophagy thing, which is very popular in mice, if you turn off autophagy, the benefits of fasting largely seem to go away. So it seems to be mediated by autophagy. But in humans, it's much harder to pin that down. And we don't really...
Hi, everyone. I'm here with Dr. Jill Carvalho, a physician and research scientist in the fields of nutrition, longevity, neuroscience, and molecular biology. So Jill has a popular YouTube channel with 160,000 subscribers and growing. And if you've ever been confused about nutrition and research, his channel is the place to go. So in his videos, he clarifies new nutrition research, fact checks, nutritional claims, and makes nutrition, diets, and the overwhelming research understandable. So Jill, why is nutrition science and advice so confusing and contradictory? Like, why we still don't have the best diet revealed?
That's a great question. I think there's a couple of factors there. A part of it is that there's a lot of variation. There's a lot of moving parts. When we talk about diet, it's this constellation of factors, right? You have all these different foods. You have the time at which people eat. You have different populations of people, different genetics, other lifestyle factors. And so it's a very difficult thing to study. But I think that the heterogeneity and the complexity is part of it. The other part is I think sometimes we make it harder or more complicated than it needs to be because there is a lot of detail that is still being figured out, but a lot of the basic building blocks are known and have been known for a long time. A lot of times the way that science is communicated by the media and on social media isn't necessarily the most empowering or the most clarity inducing for the public. And I'm not trying to bash journalists. I understand the constraints and the difficulties, but the fact is when a study comes out in science, we look at the totality of the evidence. We look at how that study fits into the context. And we also look at the methodology and how it's done. And when you do all that, things tend to make sense a lot more than when we look at a headline, which a lot of times sounds like everything you thought you knew is wrong because new study shows that X, this explosive thing, which is good for clicks, but when you look into it, a lot of times the reality is not as flashy as the headlines. So I think those two factors kind of create the perfect storm where there is a level of complexity and a level of experimental difficulty compounded by the way that things are communicated.
Yeah, it does. It is a bit confusing. And for sure, like a majority of us will see only those big headlines. And a lot of us don't have access to the original papers or don't have the scientific background and the education to interpret those. What led you to this career of making sense of nutrition debates and fact-checking world-famous Netflix documentaries, which I definitely want to discuss later? So what's your story?
Yeah, it's interesting. When I started thinking about science communication, I wasn't sure exactly what I wanted to do. I thought about writing a book. I thought about starting a podcast. And then I kind of blog also came up as an idea. Then I landed on the YouTube thing more because I kind of like the having not just the voice, but kind of the visual medium as well, because I feel like you have more layers of communication if you're able to use both your voice and your face and your gestures. So I prefer video myself. So I kind of lean towards video. Then in terms of the topic, I thought about many possibilities. At the time, I was doing a postdoctoral fellowship in a neuroscience institute. So I thought about focusing on neuroscience. I thought about molecular biology. I thought about genetics. And then nutrition ended up being one of my main interests and goes back to the work I did in graduate school. But also, I thought it was the best alignment between my areas of interest and some training that I had with public interest, and also the amount of confusion that was out there. But my perception was that there was this hunger, pun intended, for nutrition content. And the content that was out there was very flimsy sometimes in terms of science. A lot of misunderstandings, a lot of oversimplifications, a lot of personal preference dressed as science. And that has improved over the 4 or 5 years that we've been doing it. There's been other channels that try to do similar things. And so I think that the landscape has changed. And that's noticeable, but it's still early days. So that was kind of the motivation there, was to bridge the abundant scientific evidence that was available to the public. As you said, oftentimes people don't have access to the science. They have interest, but they don't know where to find it. And so it was, the idea was to take people, to open that door or that window and show people there's all this breadth of knowledge that scientists have figured out that people are just not being shown for the most part. And then we started out, and then it's been basically, you know, course correcting along the way and changing a little bit based on feedback from viewers as well in terms of topics and format, what works best. It's always kind of a tuning process or fine tuning. It's lots of fun. It's very rewarding, and it's work in progress. Like we're always learning. We're always tweaking and changing. And what we do 6 months from now is going to be different. It's going to be a little different from what we're doing today.
Okay. Do you want to give a spoiler?
Oh, in terms of topics?
Yeah.
We have a lot of stuff lined up that I'm very excited about. We have a lot. We have some really world-class content in terms of gastroenterological conditions, for example. The type of approach that we did, we really sat down with this excellent scientist who's both a clinician with 30 years of experience in gastroenterology, directs an institute that does this day in and day out, and a researcher with like 400 publications, writes the guidelines like top notch. And we really went through everything, causes and therapeutic approaches, everything that's known, and really trying to give people a comprehensive idea of what's out there. We've done that for a number of topics. We recently did that for kidney stones, for example, which is something that people ask a lot about, kidney stones and oxalates. It's really exciting because little by little, it's becoming more doable to get people of this caliber to agree to come on and to do these extended sessions. Not only do I get to help people access this level of knowledge, but I'm also sitting there getting a one-on-one masterclass on a topic by a world leader in that field who has been working for decades in that field. I mean, it's like I'm like a kid in Disneyland, right? I'm like taking notes and going, this is amazing. I should be paying through the nose for this.
I feel like that's kind of like the role of YouTube in some sense or in some way these days as well. Like, people who are suffering from some disability or disease, let's say it's an IBS, many people go to self-educate them in YouTube after having this bad doctor visit who says like, okay, take this medicine or, you know, it's just what it is and don't get help. And then like YouTube has so much knowledge and information and masterclasses. Of course, you know, we need to be very careful of the source and make sure that it's reliable because there is a lot.
Yeah.
So let's discuss some of these popular topics that confuse people in nutrition and what is the research. You have many videos on fasting. Fasting is a big topic. Everyone's talking about it. I get a lot of questions about fasting as well. I looked at some recent reviews on fasting as a background and found two reviews from last year. One was intermittent fasting versus continuous calorie restriction, which is better for weight loss. This research concluded that the significance of body weight change was more significant after intermittent fasting. Then there was another review, again, meta-analysis of RCTs, which said that IF showed less benefit over calorie restriction. So that means that calorie restriction was more beneficial than fasting, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it was confusing. What do you think are the things that, where do these discrepancies usually arise from? What explains that we have two reviews, whereas other one is promoting fasting as effective weight loss, and other one is saying calorie restriction is better?
Yeah. So a couple of things. When we looked systematically through the evidence, including meta-analyses and systematic reviews and at least dozens, if not hundreds of these trials, and we've now, like you said, we've done maybe half a dozen videos on fasting over 2 or 3 years. So we've gone through a lot of literature on this. And two things emerge pretty consistently. The first thing is that it's very common to see benefits of a fasting intervention. So you take a population, you have them fast, and you see typically some weight loss, not always, not every trial, but it's pretty reproducible. A lot of trials you see it, some weight loss, and then the usual consequences that come with weight loss, some metabolic improvements, glucose levels tend to come down a bit, insulin resistance tends to get better, lipids can sometimes improve a bit as well. Inflammatory markers tend to come down. So that's pretty common to see with fasting interventions. The other thing that's very common to see, when you have an arm that is a fasting arm and an arm that is a caloric restriction arm, which is what you were referring to. And just to clarify for people, the caloric restriction arm is usually where people are not fasting per se. They don't have a period of time where they're not eating at all, but overall they're eating less calories. So it might be they're still having their 3 meals or 4 meals or whatever it may be, but their total caloric intake might be 25% lower than a baseline, for example. And the fasting group, there's a time window of fasting that could be 16 hours or it varies, right? But mm-hmm. overall, their caloric intake might also be 25% lower than at baseline, just achieved slightly differently.
Mm.
And what you typically see, and this is pretty reproducible, is that when you match for calories across the two methods, you don't see much difference in terms of weight loss and these other metabolic improvements. So what that's telling us is that the benefits of fasting seem to come primarily, if not entirely, through helping people moderate their caloric intake. So the first thing I would look, the two reviews that you cited, the first thing I would look for is if they matched for calories across, right? Because if they don't, in some cases, they might be looking at interventions where people had a stronger caloric reduction in the fasting group, and that's expected to deliver more benefit, and vice versa for the other review, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a few of these meta-analyses and a few of these reviews where they tried to match specifically, and in general, the benefits are matched. Now, I just want to make one, before we move on, I just want to make one observation or one reservation. Sometimes when we explain this, and we explain this in videos, people get very disappointed, and some commenters even said, I'm so sad to hear that.
That fasting is not as effective or like that it's the calorie restriction.
It seems to work through calories mainly, if not exclusively. This seems
why?
To be
why very make sad. People, why know. Does it make people sad?
I don't know, but this is something that we've heard repeatedly from people, from viewers who comment. And so I just want to say that it doesn't mean it doesn't work. And the other thing that's very important to mention is that there is enormous individual variability. Some people love fasting and get great results from fasting, and some people don't like it at all and it doesn't work for them. And we don't entirely know if this is due to physiological differences or if it's just due to people don't don't like to fast that long, and so they don't adhere, right? So it's just an adherence problem. Either way, it seems pretty clear that for some people, fasting is a great tool for weight loss, for maintaining healthy body weight, for these metabolic improvements. And some people love it. It fits really well into their lifestyle. They don't feel hungry. They just, you know, it just works for them overall. And for other people, they hate it. So, and by the way, this is something that we see consistently in nutrition interventions, pretty much for anything, whether it's low fat diets or low carb diets or calorie counting or Mediterranean diet, whatever you look at, you always see this heterogeneity that works really well for some people, and then some people just don't like it. So I think that's very important to bear in mind. And at the end of the day, for people who do well in fasting and who like to fast and who like to integrate it and who get these benefits, in the real world, I don't think it really matters what the mechanism is in terms of just real life, right? You start fasting, you lose some weight, you feel better. Great. Does it really matter what biochemical pathway was activated or inhibited? For research, yeah. For day-to-day life, not really. I mean, if you're getting the results you want, whether it's calories or some other neuronal pathway or magic, who cares?
Yeah, that's a great point. And I feel like, you know, there doesn't have to be a scientific research supporting something that makes you feel great. Well, maybe if it's like an overconsumption of sugar that makes you feel great, maybe you don't want to do that based on the scientific research, but like fasting, there is evidence for, and something else might be as effective, but if it works for you, it works. And there is some research that it might, you know, increase, let's say, BHB, beta hydroxybutyrate in the brain, maybe boost some alertness, maybe boost dopamine to some people. So it might be that it's good for you because of all the other things, not the weight loss and the metabolic benefits. At least that's like the conclusion that I've come into.
That's possible. One other thing that's possibly interesting to mention is that a lot of the research on fasting is preclinical. So in model organisms, in lab animals, in mice and in rats. And now there is quite a bit of trials in humans, but it's just a note of caution for when people hear someone hyping this a lot or making claims, always look at the sources. Sometimes people make these sensational claims and they're referring to a study in mice. It doesn't mean it's bad science. It doesn't mean we don't look at it, but it does mean that we look at it for what it is, right? A study in mice is hypothesis generating. You look at it, you go, really interesting. Let's see if this pans out in humans, right? We don't make the logical leap. So just a note of caution. A lot of times when you hear these kind of sales pitches, oh, it does this and it does that and it does the autophagy up and down and it just regenerates everything and you're going to be... A lot of the stuff is based on the mouse research. And some of the things from mice, at least some of the things from the rodent research, hasn't panned out in humans. Some of the benefits and some of the mechanisms. For example, in mice and in rodents, it seems that the benefits of intermittent fasting are not all explained by calories. So you can match for calories, and you can do this pretty rigorously because you have mice in cages, right? You can control conditions very, very tightly, and you can match for calories, and the fasting group still has all these benefits. So that's a sensational finding. It doesn't quite seem to pan out in humans. And then, for example, this autophagy thing, which is very popular in mice, if you turn off autophagy, the benefits of fasting largely seem to go away. So it seems to be mediated by autophagy. But in humans, it's much harder to pin that down. And we don't really know to what extent, if any, the benefits of fasting are mediated through autophagy or not. It's much more complicated. And because in humans, they don't seem to be specific to fasting, they seem to be common to caloric restriction. And also another thing that caloric restriction also induces autophagy without fasting, right? Just the act of eating less can stimulate autophagy by itself. So I'm not trying to discourage people from doing it. I'm not trying to, you know, to be the bearer of bad news or anything, but just a bit of caution is all.
Right. Yeah, I love that. You also had a couple of videos in the channel about the timing of fasting, and that seems to have data on humans, and there is like something here to take home with.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. That's a very important distinction, because a lot of times the two are mixed together when people talk about fasting, and I think they are different phenomena. So one thing is fasting, so just not eating for a window of time. And another thing is what sometimes called time-restricted eating. So it's what time of day do you eat? So it's plays into circadian rhythms and this field called chronobiology. And there, I have seen some evidence, and not just an isolated trial, but I've seen several that suggest that there might be an effect of the time of day that you eat. And specifically, eating earlier in the day seems to provide some metabolic benefit. So even when you're matching for calories, eating the same amount of calories and the same amount of meals earlier in the day, in the morning and early afternoon, as opposed to late afternoon and evening and night, in several studies, seems to help a little bit with insulin resistance and even sometimes a little bit of weight loss compared to eating later in the day the same calories. And they've even matched this for fasting. So you can have two groups of people eating the same meals, exact same meals, in the same time window. So let's say both groups are eating in a 10 hour window, right? And fasting for the other 14 hours. Mm-hmm. But one group is eating, that 10 hour window is earlier in the day, and the other group is later in the day. So they're both fasting the same amount of time. So you're isolating the fasting component. And several studies have shown some difference in those conditions, which is really interesting because it suggests that even when you set calories aside and fasting aside, there might be a metabolic difference there just by the time of day when you eat your food.
Right.
Now, I should probably mention, again, not trying to be a party pooper, but this effect is a bit variable. There are studies that don't see it. In all likelihood, it's a less dramatic effect than the effect of how many calories you eat. Also, probably less important than the quality of the foods that you eat, right? This should always be emphasized. Yes, it matters. The total amount of calories matters. But where those calories are coming from, the quality of the foods is absolutely essential, right? Because if we're only talking calories and time of day, we're missing a big part of the picture. Okay, so I would put basically total calorie intake and quality of foods at the top of the priority or importance. And then I would put time of day as a distant number three with less certainty, because there is some heterogeneity. There are studies where they don't see the effect. And that's possibly because it's a more modest effect. So it depends on the context and what else is going on in those trials.
Right, right. Okay, so let's discuss food quality then, and macronutrients, and what are the components of healthy diets. There is a wildly popular documentary called The Game Changers, which is about athletes who follow a plant-based diet. It features basically these several high-profile celebrities like Schwarzenegger and Jackie Chan, all the cool people who endorse the benefits of plant-based diet. And it also tells stories of different athletes like Scott Jurek, who run this 2,200 miles in 46 days. And there was a powerlifting champion, Patrick Bobomian, I guess it's pronounced. Yeah, who notes that the best performance of his career came after he went plant-based. So regarding this Game Changers documentary, it almost seems like a plant-based diet makes you a superhuman. You decided to fact-check this documentary, and your video went viral. Tell me what motivated you to make that video.
Yeah, that was 3 years ago, I think, 2019, if I'm not mistaken, well, going on 4 years almost. Yeah, it was early days. I had done maybe 10 or 20 videos on the channel. I was still getting the hang of it. And that documentary was just very popular. It was very topical and everybody was talking about it. And I watched it. I thought some things were interesting. I disagreed with other things. And I thought that going through and commenting and kind of comparing both the structure and the claims to a more scientific approach would be interesting. And I mean, honestly, now if I were to go back, I'd probably do it differently. Because like I said, our content is always changing, right? And that was the first video that we made that really kind of got more exposure. Up until that point, it was still like a small, very small channel, just trying to get off the ground.
Mm.
And that video kind of pushed us to another level just by virtue of the exposure. But I thought the documentary was interesting. At the end of the day, these documentaries are not scientific treatises, right? So I think we have to understand that there's a level of narrative device that goes into place. For example, it relies heavily on these anecdotes of the athletes saying, I started eating this diet and I performed better or I felt better. And that's much more compelling for an audience than showing a bunch of bar graphs. But scientifically, it's much less compelling. So we have this kind of dilemma, right? Mm. And that's one thing that I criticized, but I understand that if you're going to make a documentary, how are you going to do it? It's very difficult to make it with a bunch of bar graphs. And also, you're probably not going to arrive at some of the conclusions that the documentary did, to be completely honest. Because things
if you look at the science, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to find this clear superiority for a completely plant-based diet when you look at the science. You're going to find a lot of nuance, a lot of variation. And you're going to end up with a scenario where, yes, in general, having a diet with an abundance of plant foods is beneficial based on all the evidence we have. But the idea that it has to be plant exclusive, that it has to be a vegan diet, as the movie never uses the word vegan, but it telegraphs pretty strongly that that's what they're talking about, is a plant exclusive diet. That you're not going to find that, not really, by looking at balance of evidence, both for health. I mean, I'm less familiar with the athletic performance angle, but in general, for health and nutrition, you don't see a clear preponderance of evidence telling us that everybody needs to be plant exclusive. In fact, if you look at the dietary recommendations and dietary guidelines from any professional health organization anywhere in the world, they don't say you have to do this. Yeah, they say you should include vegetables. You should include a lot of unprocessed vegetables and a certain amount of fiber in your diet. And then they talk about some animal foods that are better than others, right? So there's this nuance and this level of gray area and this level of doubt that is ubiquitous in science and is often much less emphasized in documentaries and things of that nature. But it's also, it's harder. Like when you try to convey that level of nuance, you lose your audience a lot of times.
Right. So where does this debate come from? Why do we have meat camp and a plant camp? What does the research show? I mean, I remember the huge, I think it was a few years ago, there was this big discussion about how meat is now found to cause cancer.
Mm.
Which then was debunked, and there was this other camp who came and said that no, actually meat is very healthy, doesn't cause cancer. What is it confusion? What is this confusion all about?
I think mainly the confusion, it comes from the fact that these things are not 0 and 100%. So you don't run one perfect study that gives you the answer with absolute certainty. That's not really how it works. Because of the complexities, right? And because of also the time scales, cancer is a good example. When you're trying to figure out if a food raises, or anything, if any exposure to anything raises your risk of cancer, that's an incredibly difficult experiment to run. You have to follow people for really for decades, right, to assess the cancer incidence or prevalence. And so you can't realistically do a randomized control trial for that. There are very rare cases where randomized control trials look at cancer outcomes. But for the most part, you're going to be looking at existing populations and their current habits. And then you're going to try to relate that to their likelihood of developing cancer. So that's how this was done for tobacco. That's how this was done. This is done for any exposure. So the evidence for this stuff from the WHO that suggests that meat, that processed red meat is a class one carcinogen, and then unprocessed red meat was a level below, is based on these associations. Then there's lots of levels of nuance. It's the strength and it's the consistency and it's how well you adjust for other potential confounders. And then it's whether there is mechanistic data, like molecular data, that aligns. So then you put basically this panel of experts sits down with these 800 studies or sometimes thousands of studies, looks at all of this landscape and tries to determine what is the degree of likelihood. So you can already see, one, the complexity and the scale of the endeavor, and two, how much room for doubt and for disagreement and also for confusion, right? Because just bearing in mind all that goes into that is complicated.
Right.
Yeah.
Like hypothetical situation. Let's say, I'm not sure if you have a sister, but let's say you have a sister and she comes to you. Okay. One of these sisters come to you, Jill, I'm thinking about going carnivore. Uh-huh. As a nutrition research scientist, I wonder if this is a good idea.
We have some viewers who are on meat-heavy diets. And I've had some examples in my family of people who ate very meat-heavy diets for periods of time. But in almost every case that I've personally seen, it's where they had some health issue and they had an intolerance to a lot of food. So they were kind of backed into a corner of elimination.
Right.
It wasn't.
I mean, in these cases, I guess it can work very well.
If they had, for example, IBS is one example where we have viewers who say, look, I can't tolerate 90% of sources of fiber, like I just get bloated and pain and all these things. So people slowly recede into a restriction diet, an elimination diet that is more and more limited. And I had some people in my family that went through that process. So, I mean, when you're in that position, I never told them, oh, don't eat that. Because what are you going to tell them? Go just bite the bullet and take the pain. And that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. In fact, I reassured my mother, for example, had to go through that. And I was the one, and she was very uncomfortable and very worried that this diet was going to raise her risk of disease, was going to make her unhealthy in the long run. And I was the one kind of reassuring her, look, you got to do this right now. What's the alternative? You're going to spend all day in pain. That's not life. So she did what she had to do. And then in the meantime, I just went through all types of scientific evidence that I could in that field related to the condition that she had. And we kept going to different specialists until we found a solution and she was able to largely reverse the condition and become tolerant again and diversify her diet. But
wow, congrats. That's an amazing story.
It wasn't fast. It wasn't easy. But the other thing is not everybody's the same, right? So what worked for her, and that's what we covered with Dr. William Shea, the gastroenterologist I was telling you about, we covered exactly this, that some things that work really well for one person, for her, it was elimination and then gradual reintroduction. And she was able to overcome her intolerances that way, very dramatically. But that process probably will work for some people and not others. So there are different resources. A lot of times, to answer your original question, a lot of times people go on these different diets and they have different reasons to do it. right? It's not necessarily on a whim. They have constraints and they have personal reasons why they have to do it, or it's favorable for them to do it. And so I think we have to work with the individual and try to figure out what they're looking for and what they're shooting for, and then help them in that, you know, on that road.
Right, right. Okay. The research that I've come across is still mainly, you know, I talk a lot about mental health and brain health, and of course, naturally navigated towards the studies on Mediterranean diet and mind diet. And the research seems to still suggest that like these kind of plant-based diets are pretty effective for long-term, especially brain health. So is there the good or the bad or the right or the wrong, or can you be on a plant-based or meat-based diet and still live a healthy and long life?
The longevity questions are always the hardest to answer because it's the hardest thing to test, right?
Right.
The only research that points at longevity directly with pertaining to diet, I mean, you can look at kind of ecological associations. So things like, people talk about the blue zones and other populations, indigenous populations and things like that. So that can provide some hints. It's tricky. It's not the best source of information because there's a lot of variables, right? And when you look at that type of data, because there's so many moving parts and we can't tell what the causal factors may be, it's basically just giving ideas that we then kind of test with other experimental designs. Then there are certain large-scale observational studies, like things like the Adventist Health Study and EPIC and some of these things that look at different diets and longevity and risk of disease. Those are useful source of information. Again, there needs to be some caution there because they are observational, and you typically are going to find that the people who are more health conscious and eat these more plant-rich diets are usually also going to be, not always, but depending on the cohort also, but there's at least that possibility that people are also more careful with other areas of their life. So that's something that you want to look for in these studies. Do they adjust for smoking? Do they adjust for BMI? Do they adjust for exercise? That's like a basic level of scrutiny. There are some randomized trials looking at the Mediterranean diet, which you brought up. Some large trials like PREDIMED, the Lyon Heart Study, CORDIAPREV is a more recent one. Basically, when you put all of this stuff together, like you crunch all of this together, consistently you see the research pointing to diets that have a substantial amount of fruits and vegetables and legumes and whole grains. And these are constant staples, right? Mm. The people always want to know the granularity. They want to know the detail, exactly how many grams of this and how many grams of that, and is it this percentage of carbs and that percentage of fat? And the more granular you get, the harder it is to answer because, you're not going to have a cohort with each exact percentage. From what I've seen, there's leeway in terms of macronutrient composition, for example. That seems to be a common source of controversy and strife on social media.
Right.
I would be surprised if that makes a huge difference based on what I've seen. So what I normally tell people is people who do better on lower carb diets. We have a lot of viewers who say, look, I've tried all these other diets, I struggled with weight. I struggled with the pre-diabetes and all these things. And then I went on a low carb diet and it helped me, and I lost the weight, and I finally am at ideal body weight. I think it's very difficult, if not cruel, to tell that person to not do it. So I think, in my opinion, and I'm not a registered dietitian, but in my opinion, the right advice is, you know, do the lower carb diet that you do well on, and just try to optimize for overall health. Like try to do a low carb diet that has some leafy greens in there, that has maybe some fatty fish in there, maybe some dairy, and that isn't like the lard and bacon version all day long. and the zero fiber version all day long, that would be the conclusion based on everything we know. Yeah, but longevity is always really, really hard. It's always an educated guess.
Yeah, of course. And we cannot really make like a randomized controlled trials. Would be very unethical to make like an assumption that this is not going to increase your lifespan and this is going to increase your mortality risk. Like you go into that group and these other people go into the healthy groups. I mean, it's a very difficult research setting. And also, yeah, the time that you need to follow and control all the other factors. I understand it's very difficult. And it's also a pretty new field, to be honest. So but I think it's very good that sometimes we don't always go into the studies, but we actually go in to look at the data on our own body, look at what is our blood markers looking like. Am I feeling happy? Is food causing me immense amount of distress? If yes, maybe something needs to be changed. If no, then good. I'm healthy. So stick with it. And yeah, like happy life, I guess, should be the ultimate goal.
Yeah, if I can add to that, because we get that question a lot. How much of the determination should be subjective? Like I feel great and I'm doing so well versus what scientific evidence says. There's this dilemma, right? And we get that question all the time. And I think it has to be both. And this is not to give the Solomonic answer and to try to touch on both and please everybody. It's not that. It's that I think it's the only thing that makes sense. You can't make long-term lifestyle decisions excluding the subjective factor. You can't do something that looks good on studies if it makes you feel terrible. That's not realistic. But similarly, right. I don't think we should exclude scientific evidence and exclusively go with something that feels good right now, because there's plenty of examples. Actually, the main diseases and the main causes of death in our society, in the Western world, are things that don't really give us a warning light early on, right? Mm-hmm. Heart disease, oftentimes the first indication is a heart attack, sometimes fatal. Cancer, by the time cancer gives you a warning, whether it's something you feel or blood work, oftentimes the cancer has been growing for years, sometimes decades. Alzheimer's, on and on and on. A lot of these diseases are chronic diseases that are insidious. Your body doesn't warn you that there's something ongoing, that plaque is growing. The warning often comes very late, sometimes too late. So I think the anecdotal aspect and the subjective aspect are crucial. No one's going to recommend ignoring that. If you eat something and you have an allergic reaction, of course you're going to pay attention to that. Of course that's going to be a factor. But sometimes the pendulum is swung too far in the other direction and people want to argue that I feel great on this diet, I should ignore everything that science has figured out. I don't think that's a good idea because there could be disease processes and your risk of disease long-term could be elevated by some practices that make you feel better in the present. So I think it has to be a marriage of the two and finding things that, yes, make you feel good and a dietary pattern that you can sustain with some pleasure, because that's important as well, that it's not a chore. It's not this, ugh, I got to eat this every day. That's not going to work. Mm. It has to be something that you can sustain for decades. But balance it out. Try to also pay attention to things that are more likely to optimize your long-term risk of health and minimize your long-term risk of disease.
Right. And I think if you do testing regularly, blood tests, that's always a good way to check if what you're doing is working or not, at least to some extent.
I think when people oftentimes say, just listen to your body, right? This is one thing we hear all the time. Oh, all the science and all this complication, just listen to your body. Just eat different diets and listen to what your body tells you. And that's all the information you need. Your body speaks different languages. Yes, pain is your body telling you something. But blood markers off the charts is also your body telling you something. So your body is communicating through different channels. If we're only listening to one, we're missing out on a lot of information. Right? And then sometimes things that feel fine in the present are going to manifest later on. So yes, absolutely listen to your body, but listen to everything your body is telling you, and also listen to the breadth of information that we have on what millions of people have experienced based on different choices. Take that into consideration. Add that to the algorithm, is what I would say.
Right. Perfect. That's such a good balanced view. And as a final question, I kind of want to make this concluding idea on, with your knowledge on all of the nutrition research that you've looked at, and I realize there is no black or white, right or wrong answer to this question, but what would you say are, what we know now, the worst foods to eat for your health and lifespan, and the best ones?
Let me start by saying that the main concern in nutrition is overall dietary pattern. I just want to emphasize that, because there is often a focus on specific foods. And the reality is, you can have a healthy dietary pattern that includes almost anything, depending on proportions, right? So it is possible to have a healthy dietary pattern that includes some ice cream or some bacon even. It's just not going to be, you know, loads of bacon every day or ice cream three times a day. But it is possible to have a healthy diet with some of these things. And I guess I already answered there some of the foods that are, yeah, I mean, ultra processed foods would be at the top of the list of things to try to minimize. And again, it's not that they can never touch them. It's, I wouldn't have them as staples. The average US person is now getting almost 60% of their calories on a daily basis from ultra processed foods.
What counts as ultra processed food?
Good question. So it's a great question, because it's not as rigorous a definition as you'd find. And there are some things that fall in the middle, but it's typically going to be, okay, soda, right? Mm. Frozen pizza, cookies and crackers and candy and sugary cereal, things that have been, a lot of natural ingredients have been extracted and a lot of artificial ingredients have been added through this extensive industrial process.
Mm.
And again, there are foods that are processed that are generally have good health outcomes, and there are foods that are unprocessed that aren't so great overall. But in general, this rule applies that most of these things that are heavily processed, packaged, in the middle of the supermarket, most of those aisles in the middle aren't great staples, right? And in general, you want to get closer to the original form of the product.
Mm.
So these ultra processed foods would be at the top, and that's the main concern. And I think everybody agrees with that. The main concern with modern diets or Western diets, processed red meats, I would say, are up there as well. Bacon and beef jerky and these things where it goes through this extensive process of drying and curing, and that seems to make these processes, these products particularly problematic. That would be at the top. So added sugars, added salt, I would add as well as another concern in excess. It's not that adding some salt to your food is necessarily a problem, but an excess of sodium seems to be a pretty common issue worldwide at this point and a common cause of disease and death. And most of the sodium is actually coming from ultra-processed foods, so they kind of blend. There's a Venn diagram there. So a lot of the excess salt comes from these ultra-processed foods that contain a lot of salt. So it's not even salt that people are adding at the table. Excess alcohol, and actually the research on alcohol has accrued that even at very low doses, it's not beneficial. But of course, the concern really rises when you get to high levels of intake and alcohol dependence and things like that. So I would add that as well as a consideration. Those would be probably at the top.
Okay. What about the other side, the healthiest?
Yeah, the healthiest foods would be basically unprocessed fruits and vegetables, legumes. In terms of animal products, it would be fatty fish. People worry about heavy metal and contamination, but there are some analyses. It depends on the type of fish. And the fattier fish has the best risk-benefit ratios, and particularly having it a couple times a week is widely recommended, and that has the best health outcomes. Some forms of dairy, particularly fermented dairy, have the best outcomes as well. So that'll be yogurt. With yogurt, I mean, the problem with dairy is it's so heterogeneous, right? There's so many types of dairy. And even within categories, even within yogurt, sometimes yogurt is this very sugary, almost like creamy candy. It's just a lot of sugar added. But if people want to go for more of a, like an unsweetened Greek yogurt or something like that would be a better option. Yeah. So those would be generally the foods that are recommended. And then in terms of fats, carbohydrates, mainly the unprocessed carbohydrates, the whole forms of carbohydrates, avoiding a lot of refined ultra processed carbs. In terms of fats, favoring sources of unsaturated fat. So that would be, again, the fatty fish, the nuts and seeds, liquid vegetable oils, which get a lot of bad rap on the internet, but the outcomes are overwhelmingly positive for those. If people are worried about seed oils because they have all this, there's all this hoopla on the internet, go for olive oil then. If that makes you feel better, go for olive oil. Go for avocado oil, seems to be popular. And then avoiding those concentrated sources of saturated fat in a large amount. So a lot of butter, a lot of fatty meats in a large amount will tend to push the cardiovascular risk factors up. That would be a general view.
Perfect. Thank you so much. I appreciate so much your time and your knowledge. It has been very insightful for me today, and I've learned a lot. And can you also tell where people can find your videos and your channels, and where can they find you?
Yeah. Nutrition Made Simple is the name of the YouTube channel. That's our main hub right now. You can find me on Twitter as well. I post on there pretty regularly. If you search for either my name or maybe the handle is @nutritionmadesthree. Because my last name is like a Wi-Fi password. People usually can't spell it. So it might be easier to find that way. We also have a Facebook page. Also, if you search Nutrition Made Simple, you should be able to find it. That's basically it.
Hi, I hope you found this episode useful and interesting. If you have any questions or you just want to participate to the discussion, you can find this episode in YouTube, and there is a comment box below where you can share your thoughts. I'm always so inspired to read your comments and personal stories in YouTube and all your questions and hear what tips were the most important for you in this episode, because this helps me to provide you more relevant information that can also help you in the future. So please don't hesitate to come and leave a comment on YouTube. I also love that many of you come there and share your personal tips and transformation stories, because this is all contributing to the community and we can all learn from each other. If you're interested in self-care, well-being, and the cutting edge science on healthy lifestyle and lifespan extension, make sure to check the other episodes as well and my videos on YouTube, and follow my free tips on Instagram.